What it's like to be in Canada, one almost feels like one's moving back to Europe when one comes up here. It's a pleasant delight. So today I'm going to tell you about some of my interests in quantum phase transitions. And this is a colloquium. I'm not entirely sure how to impedance match it to the audience, so I warmly invite you to interrupt me and take us off track if it suits the purpose at the time. So this is when I do my research, I often, you know, you often reach those points where it doesn't go too well. And you need something to lift you up and get yourself back into that excited state where you can actually do some productive work. And so one of the things I like to do is to get a historical perspective on the work I'm doing. First of all, we are very much in the Q era, the quantum era. There's an interest in everything labeled with QU before it, qubits. So I'm interested in quantum phase transitions, so in that nature, they are really new kinds of phase transitions, so why not put the label QU before them, Q transitions, and I'm going to talk about phase transitions in the quantum era. I'm going to spend a rather long time trying to put this in perspective. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is the nature of scientific revolution. Because you have to have a good idea about scientific revolution if you're to believe that it's still possible to have revolutionary ideas. Okay, I'm going to talk a bit about that. The other thing I wanted to mention today is that though I work on the physics of materials, experiments that can be done inside the lab, there's a long tradition going back to Pauli of thinking of this kind of physics as dirt physics, not really the big thing. And yet, what really happens in science, one of the truly amazing things, is that what you learn in the lab, the principles you learn in the lab, give you insights to the cosmos. And what you learn out in the cosmos gives you insights about what happens right here on Earth in the lab. And that remains true today, as it did when understanding levitating superconductors led us to an understanding of electroweak theory, or when Isaac Newton could understand the planets from studying an apple. And so that's one of the philosophies behind doing experiments in the lab on condensed matter physics. There are principles out there to be learned which may have cosmic interpretation. Okay, and I'll come back to that later. Okay, so that's the outline of my talk. I'm going to talk about from classical to quantum, and in particular about classical criticality, one of the crowning discoveries of the last century, which came from the application of ideas in quantum physics on a statistical mechanics direction. And then I'll take you into the ideas of quantum criticality and an area of research on materials which are prone to sit just at the edge of magnetic instability. And I'll tell you how observations on these systems confound our current understanding. This will lead me at the end to talk about some new approaches and ideas and introducing some very hot experimental data, which in fact suggests that we have to change our approach rather radically. Okay. So that's an outline of the talk, but I wanted to take you back to the classical era and tell you a story about classical physics. We're all taught that classical physics is a very systematic, closed area. And yet, actually, the development of understanding of classical physics was fraught with difficulty of interpretation. So my story begins in Paris, 72 years after the publication of Principia, which was published in Latin, and almost nobody could read Latin at the time. And the classical revolution was in full sway at the time with the arrival of Halley's Comet. Halley's Comet appeared in the night sky, and this led the publishers in Paris with a dilemma. There was a great interest in comets at the time, and they had at their disposal an unpublished manuscript. This unpublished manuscript, rather interesting manuscript, they brought it out in a hurry that year, and it was Principe Mathematique, and its author, you can't quite see here very clearly, but she was the Madame la Marquise Emilie du Châtelet, a very interesting early theoretical physicist, in fact. She was trained in the Académie Française. She knew the string theory of the day, which was Leibnizian calculus. And she was, in fact, the translator and interpreter of Newton's Principia at the time. Interesting. She has a number of other accomplishments to her name. Her fourth lover was Voltaire, and they worked together on physics in rather detailed way. She, in fact, enabled him to understand many of the esoteric aspects of Newtonian mechanics. She also applied her skills to gambling, and late in her life ran up an 84,000 franc debt, and invented what could be called an early version of derivatives to finance that debt, it turns out. She sold off the rights to her future profits to the French taxation system in order to cover her debt, and apparently managed to do so before she died. But her crowning achievement before she died, which she wrote actually in the last few years of her few months of her life, was this remarkable Rev Mod Fears on Principia, in which she reviewed the conflicting worldviews of Leibniz and Newton. And now you might think Leibniz and Newton, they may have conflicted on who discovered calculus, but surely they didn't conflict on the ideas of classical motion. But they did, it turned out. And they disagreed on something very, very elementary. They both agreed that Newton's momentum was conserved, but Newton thought that was the only thing that was conserved. And in fact, Leibniz had introduced a thing he called via vibra, which we would call kinetic energy today. In its early version, in fact, for the first 150 years of its formulation, it lacked the one half. Okay, incredible point. And Châtelet reviewed this issue in her Principe Mathématique. It turns out that the resolution of the controversy didn't occur in her time. And in fact, the missing factor of a half didn't appear until 60 years later with Coriolis coming into the scheme. And the concept of energy didn't occur until almost 100 years later. Okay, so you can see that 70 years after the discovery of classical mechanics, in fact, some of the main ideas were still to be discovered. It's a rather incredible thought. And so what we learn from this is that revolutions take a long time. Okay? Now, today, we're 108 years after Planck, but the quantum era is still very much in full sway, and there have been many surprises along the way. There presumably are more surprises to come along. Here is one surprise that occurred in the early days. Everyone after Bose-Einstein condensation believed that electrons must be bosons. And in fact, this included Wolfgang Pauli, who had, of course, come up with the exclusion principle. And although he had come up with the exclusion principle for electrons in atoms, it was a very great step for him to take it to the next level and assume that the exclusion principle should apply to electrons on a macroscopic scale. And this is what he wrote to Schrödinger in 1926, that with a heavy heart, he'd been converted to the idea that Fermi-Dirac was the correct statistics. He went on to write a note about Pauli paramagnetism. Okay? And this still continues. Here's another little note on revolutions being late, and this is my sound bite.
I suppose it's the sense of the unexpected. It's the sense of the frontier. You know, as an American, you grow up with the sense that there have to be frontiers out there, or you hope that there still are. And you realize that at the quantum level, there is much more that is not understood than there is that is understood. As a graduate student, I thought, gosh, I'm living in the wrong time. I was born 30 years too late. The people who had all the fun were the people who were in on the beginning of quantum mechanics. Well, I turned out to be wrong, because I was in on the beginning of what we now call the many-body problem, which is really the study of collective and emergent behavior that you find when you bring many particles together and you know their basic interactions, but you have no idea of the many and varied ways these interactions can give rise to unexpected behavior in matter, dead or alive.
So I think that's really a thesis behind what I'm going to talk about today, the collective behavior of quantum matter. And today, if there is one big problem that's out there, it's really the problem of quantum zero-point fluctuations. Now, you might think that's an absurd remark to say. Surely that was understood years and years ago. We've all studied the simple harmonic oscillator. But actually, today, in two contexts, it's a major unsolved problem of the quantum era. First of all, in the context of cosmology, current thinking is that 73% of the mass of the cosmos is unaccounted for and is called dark energy. And according to one school of thought, but not the only school of thought, it's an unidentified form of zero-point energy, which causes the expansion of the universe to accelerate. In the context of condensed matter physics, however, zero-point fluctuations we're finding profoundly transform matter and appear to endow it with a marked tendency to develop new forms of order in order to avoid the singular physics of the quantum critical point. And that's what I'm going to be talking about today. But to do that, I'm going to have to first back off and contrast quantum criticality with classical criticality. And classical criticality really was one of the crowning achievements of the late 20th century. And here is an example. Here is actually a system, terbium, rhodium, 2, silicon, 2, which undergoes both a quantum and a classical phase transition. If you cool it down through this dotted line here, it develops an antiferromagnet, albeit at very low temperatures, around 90 millikelvin without a magnetic field. So as you cool down, as it goes through this transition, it experiences a classical critical point. Classical critical behavior occurs in a very narrow region of the phase transition, and it's an extremely interesting problem. In fact, it wasn't until the early 60s that physicists realized that they actually had a problem understanding phase transitions. Until the early 60s, Van der Waals' mean field theory of phase transitions was thought to be the explanation. They had seen unusual lambda point style transitions in the specific heat of liquid helium as it went superfluid, but that was regarded as probably some kind of quantum anomaly. And so it wasn't until oxygen, mundane oxygen, was sent to its critical point and shown to have this lambda-like specific heat anomaly that the community realized they had trouble on their hands, and those solving the problem of the Ising model in two dimensions, which also was a mystery, brought it all together, and we had the birth of classical criticality. And there's a very nice quote that Michael Fisher once gave me, which is that new insights into physics often come from revisiting areas once thought to be closed, and this certainly was the case here. And there was then a revolution in the understanding of system mechanics, in which many people in the community were involved, Leo Kadnoff, Ben Widom, Anatoly Larkin, and the Nobel Prize was ultimately given to Ken Wilson, but he would be the first to admit that it was a community project here. And what did they actually discover? Well, they discovered that matter close to a critical point develops a correlation length associated with the emergent order, and that on scales shorter than that correlation length, it develops universal behavior in the sense that the physics on those length scales which are diverging is described by universal correlation functions with universal exponents that depend only very, very loosely on the microscopic physics. In fact, matter near a classical critical point forgets about its microscopic origins. Its correlations, the correlations of a magnet at its critical point, could be the same as the correlations of water at its, the classical critical point could be the same as the correlations of water at its critical point, even though the physics is different between a magnet and freezing water. So let's now talk about quantum phase transitions. These are driven not by thermal energy, but by zero-point motion. And in this phase diagram I have here, you can send yourself through a quantum phase transition by tuning yourself to a point where the classical condition temperature is suppressed to zero at this point here. Of course, you can never actually cool down to absolute zero, but you can extrapolate to the point where the transition temperature goes to zero. And in this particular case, the order parameter you're dealing with is actually the staggered magnetization of the antiferromagnet. Of course, that order parameter doesn't commute with the Hamiltonian. So there are intrinsic zero-point fluctuations associated with this order parameter. And so this raises the question, what happens when the time and length scale of coherent quantum fluctuations expands to fill the entire material? And you can do this in this system by applying a magnetic field that tunes this transition down towards absolute zero. And one of the curious things you discover is that the physics of this quantum critical point influence a large region of the phase diagram. In fact, the color coding in this diagram has not been put there by hand. It actually comes from looking at the exponent of the resistivity. In the blue region, the resistivity has a quadratic dependence on temperature. In the orange region, it has a linear dependence on temperature. And this is the color-coded code of the exponent. Okay. And so that's the quantum critical point. And of course, I've missed a picture there. Never mind. Okay. So the point I wanted to make about this quantum critical point here is that when we reach this point here is that now you're going to have a correlation length and a correlation time, which become infinitely long. And now you have the possibility of a universal quantum state of matter. What is the nature of that universal quantum state of matter, which forgets about its microscopic origins? Now, of course, if you want to study this, you can take two approaches. One, it's a try to generalize your understanding of classical criticality to the quantum domain. And I'll talk about that. But actually, the motivation to enter this area came as a community from experiment. And in fact, the original motivation came from high-temperature superconductors. Now, high-temperature superconductors have the remarkable property that in their normal state at optimal doping, they have this wonderful linear resistivity. And this linear resistivity is associated with a scattering rate of the electrons that is itself equal to the temperature. Nobody knows today what causes that scattering rate, what is the mechanism of that scattering. But we know that some aspects of the physics of the electrons are scale invariant. This is an enduring problem of condensed matter physics, this linear resistivity, unsolved since its first discovery in 1987. We're also interested in many other types of superconductor today, heavy electron superconductors, which have much smaller transition temperatures. And today also the iron oxynictides. And in all of these systems, it appears that the superconductivity may be connected with some association with an underlying critical point. One of the enduring questions that the field is asking is, what kind of electronic fluid yields high-temperature superconductivity? And one answer to that question comes from the cuprate superconductors. One answer is that actually it appears that the superconductivity may be nucleating around a hidden quantum critical point. There are indications from experiment that this quantum critical point are there, but only very recently has it become possible to apply the massive fields required to kill the superconductivity and reveal the underlying quantum critical point. And so in the meantime, the community has actually turned to systems where you can suppress the superconductivity much more readily, systems with much lower transition temperatures. And these systems are I'll talk about in a moment. This concept here is called avoided criticality, and it's one of the motivating reasons why material physicists are interested in the idea of quantum criticality. The idea is that if you can get yourself a quantum critical point, then perhaps new kinds of phases of matter will form around this nascent point of instability. Here is an example of one such heavy electron superconductor. I'm sorry, it's not as clear as it might be. I'll come back to this later, but this is a phase diagram in which you can adjust the pressure on this low TC system. It's an antiferromagnet, and as you cool it, the reduce the transition temperature of the antiferromagnet, a dome of superconductivity forms around this critical point, which you can expose by applying a modest magnetic field. The field is in this direction, the pressure is in that direction. Okay. So before I do that, I'm going to have to tell you a little bit about some of the standard assumptions in condensed matter physics, which these quantum critical points seem to question. And in fact, we have to go back to some of the oldest questions in condensed matter physics to understand this issue. And so that's what I'm going to take you through now. In fact, one of the most important ideas in condensed matter physics is the idea of adiabaticity. The idea that when you have an interacting quantum system, you can turn on the interactions gradually. And if you do it carefully enough, the excitation spectrum will be unchanged by turning on that interaction. Landau used this as a way to understand the so-called Fermi liquid. And he came up with the idea that if we take a non-interacting fluid of electrons and we turn on the interactions adiabatically, the non-interacting excitations of the Hilbert space will evolve into what he called quasi-particles, which carry the charge and spin of the bare electron. And Landau's Fermi liquid theory can be used to parameterize the physics of an interacting quantum fluid of fermions. One of the things you can do, for example, is to parameterize the renormalization of the effective mass in terms of the dipole component of the interaction. In fact, what you can then do is look at the experimental measurements of liquid helium and read off this one parameter, use that to correlate with other observations. So it's a beautiful phenomenological theory at heart, but it forms the mainstay of most of our understanding of interacting electron fluids, in particular metal physics. Okay. And here's a picture of Lev Landau meeting Freeman Dyson in 1956 during a brief warming period of the Cold War. And in fact, you can see some of the, there is Landau himself. Here is a very young Avrakozov. This is Larkin, who went on to do this great work in classical criticality. In fact, we don't actually know what they were talking about in the picture at the time. Dyson himself, who was there, doesn't remember either what they talked about on this occasion. However, one of the things they might have thought of talked about, and they certainly did during this meeting, was the idea of the Fermi liquid. And one of the questions that Landau had was, what happens when the interaction becomes too large for adiabaticity to continue to work? Okay. And this is an enduring question of condensed matter physics, and it's one for which the final answer has not been given. Okay, and let me show you various answers that have been proposed, however. Okay. So we can imagine taking the Landau Fermi liquid and tuning up the strength of interaction. In fact, we can actually do this experimentally. And so what happens when we do this? Well, one answer was the one that Landau gave, which was that the electrons order, that you have a phase transition into a state with a new form of long-range order. Could be a ferromagnet, an antiferromagnet, could be a gap system. Okay. But another answer given not long afterwards by Sir Neville Mott was actually if the interactions between electrons become too large, they can actually localize. And he imagined the problem of taking hydrogen atoms and bringing them closer and closer together till they formed a metal. And the point where the electrons delocalize is now called a Mott transition after the proposal he made. In fact, both of these answers are actually correct in real systems, and that's part of the problem. That you can't just take one paradigm, both are important. There is another answer that was given later in the 60s by Anderson, which is that when electrons localize, they also tend to form little magnets, local moments form. So magnetism is part of the localization that takes place here. And the answer that we're going to talk about today is that actually the whole game may be not just the state that's formed, but the mechanism by which the state is formed. And this point here is a quantum critical point if the transition is second order. And Hertz, working in the mid-70s, envisioned that this critical point could radically change the properties of the metal that form at finite temperatures above the quantum critical point. Okay. And it's really only been in the last 10 years that this has become an experimental issue. Hertz wrote a paper on what is now called the Hertz theory of ferromagnetic quantum critical points, and it was a footnote at the time. The community was interested in classical criticality. And one of the things we're discovering is that though he made a very fine effort at trying to solve that problem, there are many aspects experimentally that can't be understood by his simple space-time generalization of Landau theory. So I'm going to tell you about some of the experiments that have been done on quantum criticality. And for those of you who are accustomed to the beautiful, clean world of models that you solve, this is going to be an ugly wake-up call, because this is the dirty world of real materials. Nevertheless, clean ideas can come from studying dirty old materials. And I'm going to tell you about a whole class of systems called heavy electron materials, or heavy fermion materials. Here is a picture of one of them called uranium beryllium 13, and all you really need to understand about this, all I really understand about it, is it contains a lattice of localized local magnetic moments that interact with a sea of mobile electrons. And that interaction is described by a very simple Hamiltonian, one of the simplest in the world. It's a contact interaction between the density of the spin density of the conduction sea and the local moment. This interaction was first studied in detail by Kondo, although it was written down in the 50s. And what Kondo understood, and what a whole community of physicists later went on to understand, is that the effect of this interaction has a profound influence on the electron sea. In fact, what happens is that this interaction grows to strong coupling as you cool down. In fact, it's a condensed matter version of asymptotic freedom. At high temperatures, the local moments are free, but at low temperatures, they screen themselves, forming a singlet ground state, and the characteristic scale at which this singlet ground state forms is now called the Kondo temperature, and it's exponentially related to the size of this coupling constant. This is what would be called a dynamically generated mass in the context of quantum chromodynamics. And for many years, people thought this only occurred for dilute impurities. And the basic picture then is that if you take a local moment, it's free at high temperatures and large magnetic fields. But as you cool down or reduce the magnetic field, you form what is, in fact, a version of Landau's Fermi liquid. It's a singlet state which scatters electrons at the unitarity limit. And this should then have a paramagnetic spin susceptibility. And so in the Kondo problem, you have a crossover from Curie paramagnetism with a 1 over T susceptibility at high temperatures to Pauli paramagnetism at low temperatures. Okay. The remarkable thing is that this same physics occurs in dense lattices of local moments, and that if the Kondo interaction can be large enough, these singlets can form at every single site in the lattice, and so the resistivity which grows due to increasing scattering of each site eventually becomes associated with such a strong scattering potential repeated at every single site that actually it turns over and forms a coherent Fermi fluid with highly normalized heavy fermions. And the resistivity at low temperatures follows a T-squared behavior. This T-squared behavior is a hallmark of the Landau Fermi liquid. It's because the scattering rate of the quasiparticle grows quadratically with its energy. Okay, so this is the physics of heavy fermion systems. These are really magnets which didn't quite form. Okay. The interesting question then is what happens when you push this very, very fragile Fermi liquid over the edge and tip it into the magnetic state? What do you see happen? Okay. And one of the things you see happen is exactly the same thing you see in high temperature superconductors. If you take a mundane antiferromagnet, cerium indium 3, and you pressurize it, bringing its nail temperature down towards zero, then it was observed in 1998 that a small superconductor forms underneath this dome. And the community then went on to investigate this further In fact, by making this system more two-dimensional, what happens is that the TC goes up rather dramatically, and you can form a superconductor in which the transition temperature is a large fraction of an AL temperature. This system actually is a miniature high-temperature superconductor, and it displays a linear specific heat, a linear resistivity, which is associated with this quantum critical point here. Okay. So here is then the cartoon of the physics we're talking about here. You have an AL temperature which is tuned towards zero, and you form an antiferromagnet inside this region here. But as you push it through that quantum critical point, it ultimately, these local moments become screened. If you like, they dissolve into the quantum fluid and form mobile heavy electrons. One of the observations made on such systems is that as you approach the quantum critical point, the specific heat capacity follows a particular form. It is logarithmically dependent on temperature. It becomes scale invariant and doesn't have the linear specific heat that you expect in a conventional metal, doesn't actually form. This then is an indication that the characteristic scale of that Fermi liquid has collapsed to zero at this point here. Okay. If you like, the mass of the heavy electron has been driven off to infinity. Here is the system that I introduced you to at the beginning, in terbium, rhodium, two, silicon, two. It has a very fragile nail temperature, and it displays a T squared resistance here and here, the hallmark of a Fermi liquid. Here, a Fermi liquid with long range order. Here, a Fermi liquid that's a pure paramagnet. But in between here, you have a linear specific heat. How linear is that specific heat? Well, here's the linear resistivity. And in fact, that linear behavior occurs over several decades. In this system, it goes all the way up to about 10 Kelvin. This is d log rho by d log t. Despite the fact that the characteristic scale of the phase transition here is 90 millikelvin, this linear resistivity goes up through several floors up to the top of the building, over at the top of the building, so above the top of the building. Okay? And the question is, how come this system is so linear over such a large temperature range? How come a thing that's actually at zero temperature influences the physics over a very large temperature range? In fact, I think we understand that question, even though we don't understand the mechanism of the quantum critical point that sits down here. Here is, again, it doesn't come across so well, the phase diagram of cerium, cobalt, indium, cerium. This is a system, just write it up just for. Okay, yeah, sure. So this particular system is called a 115 material. And it's 115 because its telephone number is 115. It's an antiferromagnet, but as you put pressure on it, you drive the transition temperature to zero and you form a superconductor around here. What you can then do is apply a magnetic field and take it and kill the superconducting dome and cross this quantum critical point here. And if you do that, you can then make observations of what happens. One of the ways you can observe a metal is to look at the tiny oscillations in its resistivity that result from coherent motion of the electron around the Fermi surface. And this is called the de Haas van Alphen or the Shubnikov de Haas effect. And you can measure the areas of the Fermi surfaces, as was done here in this system. And you can then tune up the pressure. You can also measure the effective mass of the electrons. And as you come in towards this critical point, you can see this mass diverging gradually. And what's also interesting is that even though this is a second order phase transition, the extremal areas completely reconfigure as you go through the quantum critical point here. And as if the Fermi surface actually changes its area as you go through this quantum critical point. This then raises the question, well, if the masses are diverging on either side, what happens actually at the quantum critical point? And one idea is that the electrons are critical all the way around the Fermi surface. Before I talk about more detailed models for that, I'd like to talk about a characterization of these quantum critical points that was once given to me by a materials physicist named Zachary Fisk. And I asked Zach, how do you understand a quantum critical point? And he said to me, well, in my intuition, I think it's kind of like a black hole in the phase diagram. And one of the remarkable things is that this intuition turns out to have depths which were far greater than he could have actually realized at the time, and I'll tell you why. Okay. And so, in fact, one aspect of the problem goes back to Feynman's understanding of statistical mechanics. If you think about the partition function of a quantum system, you can write it as a Feynman path integral in imaginary time over the histories of that quantum system. And one of the peculiar things about these histories is that they have a periodicity. If they're fermions, if they're bosons, it's periodic in time. If they're fermions, it's anti-periodic in time. And in fact, you can kind of think of the effect of temperature as the effect of putting boundary conditions, putting plates in time. And we know this in field theory in space as the Casimir effect. And the Casimir effect on a quantum critical system, aka the vacuum of quantum electrodynamics, the plates can be moved apart and you can feel the pressure due to the fact that the boundary condition is affecting the zero point motion of the electromagnetic field in the plate. So temperature does the same thing, except in time. And we can kind of understand the physics in the following way. So if we think about a quantum critical point sitting down here, then at any finite temperature or any small deviation away from this point, particularly to the right or to the left, there'll be a characteristic correlation time and a characteristic correlation length. Inside that bubble, you'll have the quantum critical matter, which we'd like to characterize. What does temperature do? It gives you a window on that physics. So if we look at that window, if we're at a high temperature, then we're looking inside the bubble. We're probing the quantum critical physics. That's what's happening up here when the temperature is finite. Okay. As I cool down, what will happen is that 1 over T gets larger and larger, and that then takes me through the point where now I'm actually sitting outside the bubble, and the physics outside the bubble is then either my ordered phase or my Fermi liquid. So outside the bubble is the Fermi liquid. The question is, what's going on inside the bubble? Okay, and that's the quantum critical matter, which presumably forgets about its microscopic origins. Okay, so what's the idea about this being a black hole? Well, here's one way of thinking about it, but I'll mention another in a moment. You see, the point is, you could imagine taking a journey, tuning yourself through the phase diagram like this by tuning the pressure. What would you see if you did that? Well, in some sense, you'd be taking a journey from one universe, the heavy fermion metal universe. You'd be passing through this event horizon where you go into the region at where you see quantum critical behavior, and then you'd be going out through that event horizon on the other side into the anti-ferromagnet on the other side. And we introduced this for fun in a review article a few years ago. And it was then with some astonishment that I learned not long after that, that actually various critical models in quantum field theory, particularly in quantum chromodynamics, can actually be mapped onto higher dimensional models of quantum gravity. And the way you introduce temperature into the theory is by actually introducing a black hole into the theory. Yes? Well, okay, so in the sense that it's a colorful artist license, first of all, okay? But in the sense that the physics inside the quantum critical matter forgets about the details of the world on either side. And whether you're here or whether you're there, it doesn't know whether you're close to going into the anti-ferromagnet or whether you're close to going into the into the paramagnet. It doesn't know anything about that at all, in fact. So it's kind of separate from those two ordered universes on either side. Okay. Now, notice one thing about this picture is that it assumes there is just one point here separating the anti-ferromagnet from the from the power magnet, an assumption which was borne out by early experiments, which I'll come back to. So what are the physics of this quantum critical point? Okay, well, it's just expanding on that idea. Let's go on. One aside is that the only way in which this droplet will be quantum mechanical will be if the transition temperature goes to absolute zero. And that's because as the characteristic modes of this system become lower and lower in frequency, they'll ultimately drop below K Boltzmann T if you're sitting at a finite temperature. And so if you have a diverging correlation at any finite temperature, it must become classical at long distances. It's only if you're sitting at absolute zero that that scale becomes infinite. One other comment to make on this is that temperature plays a very different role in a quantum phase transition. In a classical phase transition, temperature tunes you through the transition. In a quantum phase transition, temperature provides a boundary condition on the physics. And so it's completely different in its role here. Okay, but what does it do? Okay, well, one of the signs that this picture is basically correct is that you can actually do experiments on the spin correlations, and you find that you can drop them onto E over T scaling curves in the two cases that have actually been looked at in great detail. Here are two systems where, looking at the quantum critical point, making large enough crystals to do the neutron scattering, you can actually probe the inelastic neutron scattering, probe the characteristic energy dependence, and drop it on an E over T scaling plot. This is evidence, then, that temperature is the only scale in the problem. And what's curious about both of these pieces of evidence is that they support the idea that there's actually a non-trivial scaling parameter called scaling exponent here. In the context of classical criticality, if you see something like this, you would typically write it in the spatial domain. You might write that some correlation as a function of Q looks like Q to the power of 2 minus eta. Then you'd have some function of Q times Q divided by 1 over L. This is canonical scaling. Here, we have Q replaced by energy and 1 over L replaced by temperature. Okay? So temperature, 1 over temperature, is the characteristic timescale in the problem. So this is like physics below the upper critical dimension of classical criticality. Okay. Which then brings me to the question of, well, does that fit in with the standard model of condensed matter physics for a quantum phase transition? What you should do, following the prescription of Landau, Wilson, Fisher, and others, to go and look at a quantum phase transition, is you should write it in space-time. Okay? And you should look at the configurations in space and time of your order parameter. However, there is one small hitch with this, and that is that you've got a Fermi surface that's creating the order parameter. That Fermi surface, however, is normally thought of as being rather well-defined at the quantum critical point, and you can think about the fluctuations of the order parameter as a kind of soft boson, an exchange boson between the fermions and the Fermi surface. And in the context of phase transition theory, you normally represent that fluctuation by its propagator, which is called an Ornstein-Zernike function. Here it is in classical phase transition theory. There is the correlation length, and there is the momentum dependence. But now, since it's coupled to the Fermi surface, in fact, Hertz realized that it would then be damped by the coupling to the electrons. This would then lead to a term, that damping term, proportional to the frequency. And what this means is that frequency and momentum don't come in with the same power. And so you must count frequency as two powers of the momentum, which means that in the counting of statistical mechanics, you count this as two units of dimension, or in general, z units of dimension. And so the correlation time here grows like the square of the correlation length. The effective dimensionality will then be 3 plus z. And that means that we're in 3 plus 2 equals 5 dimensions from the point of view of system mechanics. And since 5 is greater than the upper critical dimension of canonical phase transition theory, this means that we should be above the upper critical dimension. The critical modes are then weakly interacting. And then we shouldn't have standard scaling theory. Temperature shouldn't be the only scale. And so you see you have a dilemma here. The canonical model breaks down, is in contradiction with the key observation, okay, of scale invariance. And so there's been a huge amount of discussion over this. Could it be that these systems are actually behaving as if they're two-dimensional? And that's been a great debate, which is still ongoing, okay? But the body of opinion now tends to fall on the side of that we have a major breakdown of our understanding, okay? And so I'm going to tell you about some of the ideas around in the community very, very qualitatively, okay? This would be our theory of everything, if you like. This is the model that we know describes the physics of the problem, but it doesn't help us. We've had it since the early 50s. It's called the Kondo lattice model. But based on experimental observation and a lot of other arguments, we know that the phase diagram of this model basically contains, as we tune J, an antiferromagnetic metal, a critical point, and a Fermi liquid on the other side. What we're learning is that the modes of this model, which separate the region where the spins are condensed and the spins are bound to charge as composite fermions, these critical modes here are a fundamentally new kind of zero mode that we don't understand. Okay? And the question is there something universal here? And even if there isn't, how can we use this to understand real materials? Okay. Why isn't this an easy task? Well, part of the problem is that we're dealing with problems with very strong interactions. And what this does is it removes essential parts of the Hilbert space. When you remove parts of the Hilbert space, you project out parts of the Hilbert space, and this imposes constraints on the quantum mechanics. And the only way we know how to put those constraints back in the long wavelength physics, is to implement it by introducing gauge fields. Let me give you a simple example of this. This is a method introduced by Schringer in the 50s to describe a local spin. And the way you do it is to write a spin as a bilinear of spin 1/2 bosons, sandwiching a Pauli matrix, and the number of bosons determines the size of the spin. You can then implement this in your model, but the problem is that at each site, the number of bosons is conserved. There is a U1 gauge symmetry of this. This then raises all sorts of questions. Can that gauge symmetry break ever? It turns out if you use fermions here, that gauge symmetry breaks, and what happens is the heavy Fermi liquid. You can think of the heavy Fermi liquid as a kind of Higgs phase of these U1 or SU2 symmetries. Now, if you want to do control calculations, what can you do? Well, one of the methods in the bags of tricks is to use a so-called large N expansion to find families of models. You have no small parameter, but look for families of models which contain the same essential physics, but contain, rather than two spin components, N spin components. And then you would like to take N off to infinity. And when you do that, it turns out that 1 over N plays the role of Planck's constant. And we're still learning new methods to do the large N expansion. Some of the methods that the condensed matter physicist needs aren't the same as those needed by particle physics. Often we need new kinds of symmetries as N goes off to infinity. So whereas, for example, in particle physics, SUN rules the roost because SUN is connected with quarks and a singlet of SU3 is a baryon or a meson, in our game, SU2 rules the roost, and we have two types of singlets. We have the Cooper pair and the particle hole pair. And to generalize that, we don't need SUN. We might need some other symmetry. And one symmetry that's very interesting to us is the symplectic groups, but that's another story. Okay. So let me tell you about some of the ideas that have been out there. These are a cast of characters in the field. One idea is the idea that this critical physics might be intrinsically local in character. This has gone by the name of local quantum criticality. It's associated with the work of Chi Miao Si and Kevin Ingerson and the collaborators. And the idea here is that, well, what could you do if you could solve a single impurity problem in a critical environment? And they've done this, and they found that they could get very interesting physics. Their physics was motivated by the observation that indeed the spin correlations in cerium copper 6 gold appear to be local in character, in the sense that the susceptibility has an energy dependence and a temperature dependence which doesn't depend on the Q vector here. So they tried to mimic this in their model, and they got more than halfway there, but with one small glitch, it required a two-dimensional spin fluid for it to work. And we know these systems have three-dimensional spin fluids. And so this was a good attempt, but didn't entirely get all the way there. Okay. Other ideas that are around. Well, one idea proposed by Sental, Sachdev, and Vishwanath and others is the idea that we might have new paradigms of phase transition when we bring in quantum mechanics. And they introduced the idea that there might actually be two diverging length scales at certain types of critical point. In that picture, then the critical matter would then be surrounded by something that is almost a phase in which the excitations are deconfined excitations, free spin-ons, which would then ultimately confine at some much larger length scale. This crossover here would still dominate the physics. And they've been able to make some progress applying this to simple insulating frustrated antiferromagnets. Some of the ideas that I've been involved in have been trying to borrow from classical critical theory, where we have a large N expansion called the spherical model, and try to find a spherical model for this Kondo lattice. And we've met with mixed results. Okay? That's a polite way of saying that we haven't succeeded. Okay? But one of the ideas here is that the electron might break up into its components, spin-on and hole-on components. Okay? So, in fact, one of the reasons we might all have been on the wrong footing might be because we're missing some key experimental fact. And this is what I want to talk about at the end, and just for a joke, I put the Q there, quantum frustration. And actually, there is something serious about this. In fact, there's two pieces of physics going on in these systems we've been looking at. One is something called the Kondo effect, which I talked about. But the other fact is the fact that the emergent order itself has its own zero-point fluctuations, because its order parameter is not a constant of the motion. And so we can look at the phase transitions from an antiferromagnet into a paramagnet from two points of view. One is we can increase the Kondo parameter, the strength of the coupling to the conduction C. And what happens in some sense is that the magnetic moments dissolve into the conduction C. We don't understand this critical point, but we know what happens either side of it. But we can look at the problem from another point of view. And this has been the axis, in some sense, has been studied for much longer, the axis of antiferromagnetism, where we can increase the quantum fluctuations via a variety of different methods. We can, for example, take an Ising antiferromagnet or ferromagnet and put a transverse field. And we then pass through to a point where we develop power law order, for example, in one dimension. That's then a quantum critical point. We can do this by, theoretically, by tuning the size of the spin, making the spin much smaller. And in large N models, we can melt the antiferromagnet and we form a spin liquid. So the question is, how can we combine these two pictures? So one idea is to imagine taking an antiferromagnet and now coupling it up to a conduction C, this point antiferromagnetic interaction. And then if we can do that in the right way, presumably we can connect these two phase boundaries here. That's very interesting because down here, the spin liquid will then be immersed in a conduction C. There'll be a conduction C in which the electrons basically don't see the spin liquid. And when that happens, they have a small Fermi surface. Out here, however, these local moments have dissolved into the Fermi C and increased the number of carriers. So the Fermi surface has a larger volume. They've delocalized, if you like, as they go through this transition. This then means there must be a boundary that connects the spin liquid metal to the heavy electron metal. This is the boundary where the spins delocalize. And maybe the physics of electron localization plays a very important role in this phase diagram. And so you might ask, well, are there any experimental evidence for this? Okay. And is there a way in which we could tune Q here, the amount of zero-point fluctuations? Well, you just have to look at the data. So one thing you can do is you can take this material, terbium, rhodium 2, silicon 2, and you can expand the lattice by doping in iridium or doping in germanium. And it turns out that actually what happens when this occurs is that the nail transition seems to separate away from the point where the Fermi liquid seems to start. You can also put pressure on the system by doping it with cobalt. And what then happens is the nail temperature actually goes past the point where you see signatures of the Fermi surface changing, pushing it out to the right-hand side. And if we look at this data from the point of view with lover's eyes, then we might imagine that actually what we're seeing here is three different systems where we tune this frustration parameter to the point where we actually pass through an intermediate phase, which is this spin liquid metal. And perhaps this is the spin liquid metal. In fact, this is the region where linear resistance is seen to come down to absolute zero. In fact, this isn't the only example. There is a more frustrated system which has been looked at for some while now in Iowa. This is some terbium silver germanium. The system has an immensely complicated magnetic phase diagram at low fields. But when you kill the antiferromagnetism, there's a region of about 2 Tesla wide where you see linear resistivity. And in fact, this system hasn't really been studied at great depth. It could well be a very important system for us because you can grow massive crystals of this material. And you can then presumably put them in this modest field and look at this system under a neutron spectrometer and look at the very long time correlations down here to try to characterize this phase here. Okay. And so this is another example of possibly a non-Fermi liquid phase as opposed to a non-Fermi liquid point. And you see, it may be that one of the reasons we haven't gotten to the right description of the matter is that there may be a region of a new kind of metallic phase here, a strange metal phase existing between the antiferromagnet and the heavy Fermi liquid. I'm basically done now, but we have actually been trying to understand this problem using a large N treatment of the Kondo lattice model. What then happens is that we arrive at a model in which the Kondo physics can be thought of as dissolving a spin, breaking it up into an electron and a background spinless holon with a filled Fermi C, whose background expands the size of the Fermi surface. We can then explain various aspects of the Fermi liquid that forms in this picture. And one of the things we're looking at is what might happen to this background sea of holons as the gap collapses. And there is the interesting possibility of non-electron-like excitations forming over a finite region of the phase diagram. In fact, I wanted to really turn back to where I began and tell you about a conjunction of ideas that seems to be taking place. And in fact, it really brings me back to this theme at the beginning, which was that the superconductor and the cosmos are linked. And in fact, there's a paper that just occurred on the web just a couple of weeks ago by a group at MIT who've been discussing with Central there about quantum criticality. What this group has succeeded in doing is using holography, which is this method of mapping a large N model of QCD onto a classical black hole in one higher dimension. What they've been able to do is to look at the physics of a black hole which contains charge. And when it contains charge, you have a charged black hole, the corresponding physics back in 3+1 dimensions has a Fermi surface. And they've made a first stab at looking at the correlations of the fermions on that Fermi surface. And they find that they have power law correlations. If you like, the quasiparticle of Landau is replaced by a branch cut. What is interesting about this is it corresponds with the intuitive discussions by Phil Anderson recently, who's been proposing for some time now, but been looking at data, to support his ideas that actually you can actually form phases of matter where the underlying quasiparticles are hidden by what is called in condensed matter physics an X-ray catastrophe, and they then get power law correlations. And he's been interpreting various strange experimental data in this language. It's rather interesting that these two papers came so close together from two very different fields. There have also been a number of other papers I want to mention, in particular this paper by Sentel, talking about critical Fermi surfaces and non-Fermi liquid metals. I think this is a field that is prime and really ready for a phase in which new tools, possibly coming from outside condensed matter physics, can actually be used usefully and applied in conjunction with real experiments on real dirty materials to get insight into those calculations. So I'm going to end at this point. All of these papers have in common the idea of a critical Fermi surface with branch cuts replacing poles and possibly new kinds of deconfined excitation. I'm going to mention, as I end up here, a whole bunch of people who I've collaborated with recently and over time, in particular, Andrei Nevedomsky, a postdoc who used to be at Sherbrooke but is now at Rutgers, and Maxime DeZero, and also former graduate students, in particular my current graduate student, Rebecca Flint, and Jerome Reck, who is now in Munich. So what this talk has done is various things. I think perhaps the most important take-home message is that revolutions take a long time, and I think we're just at the beginning of the quantum era, not after all the important key discoveries have been made, but actually right slap bang in the center of it, just like Emily de Chatelet was 70 years after Principia without the understanding of energy. Quantum transitions, these are phase transitions driven by zero-point fluctuations. They give us the chance in condensed matter physics to look at zero-point fluctuations associated with fermions and order parameters in a completely new light. And there are many surprises that certainly don't fit in with our standard model. Temperature is a boundary effect in time. It's like a Casimir effect. The Landau quasiparticle almost certainly breaks up at certain quantum Q transitions. And in condensed matter physics, there's a need for a radically new kind of theory. And there's ideas floating around at the moment of confinement, deconfinement, certainly gauge theories, and certainly large N methods. What comes out of this melee will be very interesting to see in the next few years. Thank you.
You mentioned that in one of the theories that the dimension has to be two, and you also mentioned that Sentel and Kolliker have two diverging length scales, and later you mentioned another proposal that you go actually to a regime that you have a non-Fermi liquid phase instead of point. Were these later two pictures consistent with the dimension has to be two, the spatial dimension?
Okay, so first let me comment on spatial dimension equals two. So spatial dimension equals two is the marginal dimension for the standard model, if you like, of an antiferromagnetic spin density wave forming around a Fermi surface. And so in the standard model, you would think, well, I'm just beginning to enter this interesting regime in two dimensions. And one of the things you can do is you can get the log specific heat out of that very naturally. So it scores 1 point on that thing. The main problem is that although we love to think about two-dimensional systems, they're elegant, we have the quantum Hall effect, and the Cooper-Briggs superconductors are extremely two-dimensional, these systems are manifestly three-dimensional. And you can very finely tune them to try to make them be two-dimensional, but we don't have any intrinsic mechanism by which the spin fluctuations would cut off in one dimension and behave as if they were two-dimensional. So I think that's really an escape hatch to try and save the conservative theories, which doesn't really work. And once you take that away, there's no reason to connect yourself with three dimensions at all anymore. So coming to your other questions, one was about deconfined criticality. This was applied to a two-dimensional model of antiferromagnetism breaking up into a spin liquid. And one of the reasons it was applied there is that there is some evidence, disputed, by the way, that for a two-dimensional antiferromagnet, as you increase the spin fluctuations, for example, by stirring the electrons around with ring exchange, it undergoes a second order phase transition into a state with a new order parameter.
So one of the questions that arose then is, how can two order parameters vanish at the very same point? Okay, and in the heavy electron systems, there aren't two order parameters vanishing at a point, but there's a Fermi temperature going to zero at the same point where the Nail temperature goes zero. That's a little bit like two order parameters go to zero at some point, perhaps. And so deconfined criticality was proposed as a way to try and explain this phenomenon. Unfortunately, it's still very much, it may well be that the picture that was proposed works on intermediate length scales, but actually ultimately is taken over by a first order phase condition in real models. But nevertheless, it was a very stimulating idea, which is still very much out there, but doesn't involve charge. Okay. Also, there's no calculational tool that goes with it. There's no beautiful fit like an epsilon expansion or 1 over n expansion or even Monte Carlo that can get you there to study that physics. So it's very difficult to grasp hold of it, unfortunately. But it's a very promising idea. As regards three-dimensional systems with charge, we're groping at the moment, okay? It's clear that we have to make some abstraction that isn't there at the moment. And what that abstraction is, whether we have to tune dimension, whether we have to take a large end limit that connects us with some conformal field theory in higher dimensions, this is an open question at the moment. I would say the great thing about this is it's wide open right now.
So the era of classical critical phenomena gave rise to basically the Higgs phenomena and the standard model. And the standard Landau theory became the standard.
That's true.
And so forth. So would you care to speculate on whether if we understand new forms of quantum criticality and we get a conceptual toolbox to understand that, whether there might then be a feedback into fundamental physics that is perhaps constituents of the quarks and the leptons or constituents of gauge fields?
I think you've made the speculation, right? So historically, it was really the understanding of the ordered states of matter that led to the Higgs picture. Landau's simple theory of the order parameter, when coupled to a gauge field, could immediately be generalized to give electroweak theory. It's amazing how close the two are. That's really an example of where studying something in the lab really gave rise to new confidence that you could do field theory properly and invent the standard model. And the connections, historical connections, are very well mapped out now, how one field led to the other. In this particular case, all I can say at the moment is that there seem to be threads that are coming together. I would like to believe it would go both ways. I'd like to believe the tools from modern quantum field theory, quantum gravity, string theory would be useful in the condensed matter domain as they have been in the past. Of course, that's very painful when you get older to have to learn those new tools, but usually they should make life simpler for you if you can understand the toolbox and get the dictionaries that will help you out. And there are many in my own field who are now talking to the phenomenologists in particle physics. Phenomenology, of course, in particle physics has a new meaning today. In the old days, it meant that you were able to look at cloud chamber pictures and go right down to the beam line and talk to people. Today, it means something new. It means the ability to think in less than 10 dimensions. Those kinds of phenomenologies are very interesting for the condensed matter physicists. They have lots of wonderful new stat-mech problems that we can look at and learn about. So that's a dialogue which I think is growing at the moment. And this paper by the MIT group is one example of those dialogues at the beginning now. So as regards to other speculation, of course it will feedback. Because the thing that we have is that we can do experiments very easily and very cheaply. And there's bound to be stuff out there that we don't expect, right? And it will affect our stuff in the lab, but that will also mean we have to fine tune and correct our theories of critical phenomena in the lab. If there's any universality out there, then it'll feed back, right? You can then go back and say, okay, so you've given me an understanding for the black hole that's got charge that leads to a Fermi surface, but what happens if you take that Fermi surface away? It's bound to be different to what you first imagined. So I think there is strong grounds for collaboration and overlap of the two fields. I just can't imagine where it would go to. You can't do that, I think. But I think you have to have a very open mind about what will come out of all of this. It's bound to be, I think, the reflection, the reverberation between physics in the lab and physics in the cosmos, which has been going on since Newton's time, didn't just stop in the 20th century. Must be going on now.
In another point of view, for example, it seems to me that it's a remark, not a question, that the debate between the mode pictures and the first principle pictures of the depiction of crystal system or solid state system is perhaps giving somewhat way for approaching this problem. This is, has to do with the fact that, for example, we have argued that in a simple hydrophobic approach, a simple filter, when you consider as the Dirac formulation of the hydrophobic problem, in which the spins is not restricted to E of alpha and beta, the signal, when you, in a simple model of the copper oxide planes of the lanthanum copper oxide, you have that, for example, the gap is radio gap of the lanthanum and the antiferromagnetics, which is in this mean a field approach is represented by each opening, which each opening happens at the top of a single particular wave, which is antiferromagnetic itself, and is not of the orientation one half or minimum one half. And in this sense, you can also find at zero temperature solution will have pseudo gaps, which are perhaps related with this problem. And the pseudo gap solution is higher than the antiferromagnetic one. And this, and there is, we have the expectation that after doping, for example, you can find a patient's issue.
So I think, if I understand, I don't really understand the details of what you're saying, but you're saying that there are definitely scopes for combining the Mott picture of local moments with more delocalized pictures, and you get new insights from that. I think that's quite likely. Yeah, very interesting.
I see that the point is that perhaps the Mott problematics is in some way related with the fact that you define the correlation and the difference between the exact results and the hydrophobic one. But in solid state physics, we find the best hydrophobic difference.
I think this is a bit too technical for the current audience, though, probably. So we should go back, talk about it afterwards. Yeah.
Thanks.